The Guardian. For those of us who are unhappy with recent political events, to put it mildly, it can be tempting to suggest that something terrible has happened to democracy. And while there are those who say we should have seen it coming, that Trump and Brexit were both predictable products of our current political system, what if that niggling doubt turns out to be right? What if democracy is under threat from right-wing billionaires and the powerful technology they're able to use to their own political advantage?
It's an absolutely fundamental threat to our democracy and to our sovereignty. People really haven't woken up to the kind of danger, I think, that we are in.
I'm Jordan Erica Weber, and in this series, we're looking at internet-enabled dystopia and how even technology designed to do good can end up causing harm.
Can I explain Brexit and to the election of Donald Trump?
The book does that and shows that if it hadn't been for the social network platforms, particularly Facebook, it would have been almost impossible for the Brexit campaign and the Trump campaign to succeed.
In the first episode, we discussed to what extent our privacy is under threat from companies like Facebook and Google that gather masses of data from us so they can use it to make money. In this show, we'll look at what happens when that data is used to sell us not just commercial goods, but political ideologies.
The thing I often talk about is like how it started out.
This is Carol Cadwalader. She has written several articles for The Observer about Cambridge Analytica, which describes itself as a company that uses data to change audience behaviour, but which was described to Cadwalader by a former employee as this dystopian data company that gave the world Trump.
I was perplexed by it. And then
her articles are currently the subjects of legal complaints on behalf of Cambridge Analytica and its parent company, SCL Elections. Cadwalader herself has become a target for abuse, including a video of her face photoshopped onto the body of a woman being beaten. The story began, as she tells it, with some late night Googling.
It was like this dark and stormy night shortly after Trump had got elected. And I started looking into fake news. I got really intrigued by Google's search results on something or other. And I was like, how does Google search even work? And then I started just Googling weird stuff. And I just got this set of like horrific results that I couldn't believe I was seeing. I was typing things around Judaism and Jewish and Jews, and I put "are Jews" into the search box. And like Google suggested, its first suggestion was "are Jews evil?" I was like, what?
If you've used Google search before, you'll know that when you start typing your search term, suggestions will pop up for how you might like to complete your entry. So type in "chips with everything" and you get "chips with everything play", "chips with everything podcast", and "chips with everything meaning". Type in my name and you get Jordan Erica Weber age, Jordan Erica Weber Instagram, and Jordan Erica Weber wiki, the answers to which are 27, J-A-W-S-E-W, and I'm not famous enough to have a Wikipedia page. These Google search suggestions can be entertaining. Sometimes they read like poems, as demonstrated on googlepoetics.com. But sometimes they're horrifying.
And I was like, well, OK, what happens if I press return on that? And I press return, and I just got a whole page of results, every single one of which said, yes, Jews are evil. And the very top result was a Nazi website, Stormfront. And I found this across a whole range of searches on all sorts of different contentious subjects. So women were evil, Islam was evil, the Holocaust never happened. I was perplexed by it. And then I rang Google, I put in official queries to them. They denied there was any problem, but then they started deleting results and started deleting the auto-suggest box.
Curious as to how these extremist websites had managed to make their way to the top of Google's search results, Cadwalader got in touch with Jonathan Albright, who at the time was an assistant professor of communications at Elon University and is now director of research at Columbia University's Tau Center for Digital Journalism.
And he was the first person who was telling me about the way that people's data could be kind of collected by firms and then used against them. And he told me about this company, Cambridge Analytica, which had worked in the Trump campaign and it had also worked in the Leave campaign.
Albright introduced Cadwallader to Cambridge Analytica, helping her to understand how a company that uses data to change audience behaviour could affect a political event like the 2016 US presidential election or the Brexit referendum of the same year. We asked her to summarise how the process might work.
They're using data to micro-target people with advertisements.
The bear is easy to see. Others don't see it at all.
In the olden days, we had political adverts that everybody saw. They're on billboards in the street or they're on the television.
Since no one can really be sure who's right.
And now what's happened is social media platforms have enabled this completely different form of political advertising. You know, it happened in the Obama campaign, and what we've seen in the last election is it's been taken to a completely sort of new level. And what it means is that on Facebook, which is the biggest medium for it, people will get an advertisement for a political party that only they will see. Nobody else will see it. We've no idea what it says. That's not recorded anywhere. It's not archived anywhere. Academics can't see it. And so it's a completely different conception of politics, which is happening now in the dark, in private, unaccountable, and it's just changed everything we know about politics. People are nudged in certain directions. The government set up its own nudge unit to just try and subtly kind of push people in a certain direction.
Let's take a break. Afterwards, we'll meet someone who's helping to shine a light on this new kind of politics.
All an algorithm will know is what they measure, which is the same for advertising as it is in politics. It's engagement, time on the site, who shared what.
Welcome to The Start, a brand new weekly podcast from The Guardian.
Without those kind of engaging with reality, I will not become I worry today.
Each episode reveals a story of artistic beginnings, as told by some of the great artists of our time.
For me, Scandalicious, so much of that was also about me finding my way.
Focusing on one piece, they share how these early moments of creativity shaped them, the influence it had on their subsequent work, and what the piece now means to them in retrospect.
The most I've ever seen in any room, you know, looking at any kind of art, was in Mr. Barnes's two rooms.
To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search The Start on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Tips with Everything. I'm Jordan Erica Weber.
Well, there are two issues to consider when understanding the power of data in modern politics.
Let's meet Ravi Naik, Head of Public Law and Public International Law at ITN Solicitors.
Firstly, is the power of the platforms, and secondly, the ability to micro-target.
Naik is currently helping his clients to reclaim their personal data from Cambridge Analytica. Although the case involves US citizens and a US election, Naik and his clients are able to use British laws because Cambridge Analytica's parent company, SCL, is based in the UK.
Our clients asked the companies involved to provide their data to them. Our clients were concerned that their data had been used against them in the election. They asked the company, can you please provide our data under the relevant jurisdictional rights under the Data Protection Act? They were given certain information. Our clients were very concerned that that information was not complete. But the information they did get was shocking to them. It showed them graded, ranked and scored on their intimate political beliefs.
The story plays out on Facebook. The data that Cambridge Analytica used was legally obtained from Facebook, and just as your Facebook feed is full of adverts for clothes or pregnancy tests or whatever else the algorithms have determined that someone like you might want to buy, Facebook has also become a platform for political advertising.
And this is a problem of design. Any line in these platforms attempting to separate commerce from politics is not something that the software can do. All an algorithm will know is what they measure, which is the same for advertising as it is in politics. It's engagement, time on the site, who shared what. And that works, and it works in the same way in politics as it does in commerce, by getting a reaction out of people.
In conventional elections, they would have been outspent and defeated. But social networks are extraordinarily powerful in our time. People, I think, still underestimate this. Think of it, 45% of Americans now get their news from Facebook.
And political sales techniques that maximise engagement can have troubling implications for democracy.
And that makes Facebook, in effect, the most powerful content publisher in American history, perhaps in world history.
As we've discussed on previous episodes, companies like Facebook use complicated algorithms to decide what to show each user. And Facebook wants you to click on things, so you're more likely to see the kinds of adverts that encourage you to click. When those adverts are political in nature, that's troubling.
See, one problem is that a system that tries to maximise engagement will inherently push people towards the fringes, the extremes and the shocking. And the algorithms have learned that users interested in politics respond more if they're provoked more, so they do provoke. And as they do, they get more clicks and more traffic. And as the traffic comes through, the algorithms continue to put context first and foremost that's going to get more engagement. So one example, Facebook in 2012, I think it was, data scientists manipulated Facebook for, I think it was 700,000 Facebook users. And for half of the audience, they were shown positive stories and the other half were shown negative stories. And they measured the reaction. So after that was over, the manipulated voters were more likely to post either positive stories or negative stories depending on what they had been fed. When you start to think about that power and that influence, these problems start to get worse when third parties get involved and are allowed to use these algorithms to target a specific audience.
So when a third party wants to use Facebook's algorithms to maximise engagement with their particular political message, they might use a company like Cambridge Analytica to micro-target individual voters who the data indicates might be more susceptible to influence.
So how do you move from having this ability to use algorithms and platforms to then influencing people, the distinct things? Well, the missing ingredient is knowledge of how to target. By knowing the electorate personally and on an intimate level, you can target. That is the concept of micro-targeting. Now, these techniques of micro-targeting were writ large and used to great effect in the US election and allegedly in the Brexit referendum.
I think one of the key findings, which sort of comes up time and again and which Leave totally conned onto in news and also Trump did, was just this thing about emotional messages just play so much better. They're what goes viral. They're the things that people share. It's that shock, wow, that visual, that image. So reasoned debate about the economy or the benefits of the EU, that's increasingly not the thing that engages people, this polarisation that's happened.
A huge new Pew Research Center study of 10,000 American adults finds us more divided than ever, with personal and political polarization at a 20-year high.
And that's occurred again in these kind of closed gardens of the internet, where one side is becoming more polarized one way and the other side is becoming more polarized the other way. And this common culture, which we've traditionally had TV and newspapers, these kind of political election campaigns which were all out in the open, that has gone. And I think it is really difficult and troubling to see a way back from that.
And what we're finding is more and more people consistently answering all of those questions in a liberal or a conservative direction. Still a minority at 21%, but doubling over the last 20 years.
Politics used to be this thing which was done out in the open. And, you know, politicians, they came up with a set of policies and then these were debated. And we as a sort of nation and a public talked about them and then we went and voted. And now that isn't what happened. It's more like the feedback's coming the other way. You sort of see what people get really cross about. And then you target them on the basis of that. So if somebody's like really cross about the fact that their kids can't get into the local school, you know that through their online behaviour. And you can say, well, actually, if you're unhappy about your kid not getting into this school, here's a policy for you. you're not held to that promise because nobody knows what it was. And you can say a completely opposite promise to the person who lives next door to them. So there's just this kind of unaccountability and invisibility.
You think how these platforms are designed. Their entire business model is on traffic. They depend on clicks. Those clicks have consequences. Every time you click through a page, it drives traffic. And that traffic feeds back into the algorithms, which then determine what you should see. Now, social media has developed completely sophisticated algorithms based on opaque rules that nobody really understands. I'd be surprised if Facebook even really understands. But those rules lead you to see what Facebook determines you should see and determines you would want to see. Now, as a result of that, we end up becoming splintered. We end up becoming siloed from each other and seeing what we already believe in. Now, when no two people see the same things and people stop engaging in discourse, matters are driven underground, which have huge political ramifications. It was before the case that you could challenge information where it was flying under the radar because it was based on nonsense. Now you're faced with a reality that 126 million ads can be seen by people without Facebook even realising, which had a sway on the election.
Thank you. Do you know the safest place in the world to be is at a Trump rally?
This has quite troubling democratic implications because it moves political communication into the private sphere where it used to be public. And political speech that used to go behind the radar used to get picked up and checked and questioned. But in this way, it's able to be targeted to a particular individual and nobody else may see that same advert.
And Facebook doesn't seem willing to be held accountable for what goes on behind its closed doors.
We can't look inside Facebook and say, well, maybe that account's fishy and maybe that one. We're reliant upon them. And they have been in denial and refusing until they were dragged, kicking and screaming in front of the Senate right. Intelligence Committee and things.
How did Facebook, which prides itself on being able to process billions of data points, and instantly transform them into personal connections for its user, somehow not make the connection that electoral ads paid for in rubles were coming from Russia?
The idea that these mechanisms of persuasion could be politically useful actually goes against their treasured ideas, that they're apolitical, they're just technology companies. Indeed, it's only belatedly after the election and before these companies were called before the Senate Intelligence Committee, the tech giants revealed the extent of manipulation of their use.
That's a threat our security team was intensely focused on and we think effectively addressed. I think in hindsight, we should have had a broader lens. There were signals we missed and we are now focused.
People are buying ads on your platform with rubles.
Facebook stated that it had identified 80,000 Russia-linked posts on its platform relating to interference with the election, and that those posts were seen by 126 million people. Right, and to quote, many of the ads and posts we've seen so far are deeply disturbing, seemingly intended to amplify societal divisions and pit groups of people against each other. They would be controversial even if they came from authentic accounts in the United States, but coming from foreign actors using fake accounts, they are simply unacceptable. That's not a quote from the committee, that's a quote from Facebook's lead counsel, Colin Stretch.
The issue of data-driven, personalised political advertising surely becomes more serious when you learn that it's not just local political parties advertising their own ideas, but outside forces using this process to attempt to sway elections, like Russia trying to affect the political direction of the US. and maybe the UK.
There was a Danish military expert who I spoke to. He's an expert in information war. This new arena of warfare between states is happening online. And I said to him, you know, but people just say, you know, I know that's happening in theory, but what's that got to do with me? You know, he was just sort of like, well, good luck to you if you want to believe that. But in every single medium, these forces are out there and we're not really aware of it. And it is difficult to know, you know, even what is real and what is fake and who's behind it. I guess that was that really good example, which was that picture which we all saw of that woman with the headscarf walking across Westminster Bridge. You know, it had been on the front page of newspapers. Apparently she was completely oblivious to this attack, this terrible terrorist attack. Completely fake. She was calling her family to let people know that she was safe. And that was disseminated by a Russian troll account being paid for by the Russian state. And that had been tweeted out on Twitter. And then that got picked up by other accounts. And then that got picked up by newspapers. And then that was on the front page of our newspapers. And that informs all sorts of things. And I think that's one tiny example of a tiny number of accounts which have been identified. And if you think of that at scale and the impact it could have had on sort of national debate around issues like immigration and Islam before the referendum, I really find that very troubling.
This kind of fake news and political micro-targeting on a mass scale is a fairly recent development, and it's hard to know how to deal with it, given the electoral laws we currently have.
One of the really fundamental things which has come out is just the fact that our electoral laws don't work anymore. There was a working group earlier this year, academics from the LSE and from King's College, and they brought together people from the Electoral Commission and the Electoral Reform Society to discuss the way that the platforms had changed political campaigning. And essentially, we've always had this in Britain, we've always controlled the money in elections, and that's the basis of our electoral law. And now there is no way of controlling the money anymore, because anybody can just pour money into Facebook to do, you know, place adverts, and that's unaccountable. We've got no idea. And they don't even have to be marked as political adverts. So, for example, we know that Russia, during the US election, it paid in rubles for tens of thousands of political advertisements. And they weren't even necessarily in support of a political party. They were just agitating around immigration or sort of other divisive issues. We know that was made possible through technology. And it's really the way that technology has just changed incredibly recently the entire landscape of electioneering. What we've seen in kind of like more or less 4 years is the decades upon decades of legislation that we have, most of which was formulated in the 19th century. Most of our laws around elections come from the 19th century, and they're absolutely helpless now. So it just means that any motivated actor, it could be Russia, it could be a US billionaire, it could be a fringe group in this country, it could be China, they're all completely free to just pour money into Facebook and to Twitter and to Google ads and try and influence our elections. It's an absolutely fundamental threat to our democracy and to our sovereignty. People really haven't woken up to the kind of danger, I think, that we are in.
What do I have to get involved with Putin for? I have nothing to do with Putin. I've never spoken to him. I don't know anything about him other than he will respect me. He doesn't respect our president. And if it is Russia, which is probably not, nobody knows who it is, but if it is Russia, it's really bad for a different reason.
We know that all across Europe, Russia actively funds political parties and has tried to disrupt elections all across Europe. It's just common sense makes you realise that actually it's just not possible. There was this historic vote which would weaken Europe's ability to stand up to sort of Russian influence, weaken NATO potentially, and that Russia would sort of stand back and have nothing to do with that. So I think that is dawning now upon more people. The question is like, what's actually going to happen from that? It's not enough for us to realise that in theory, as Theresa May did. You've actually got to do something now.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press. Let's see if that happens. That'll be next. Yes, sir.
In a recent speech, President Putin said that while the interests of states do not always coincide, strategic gains cannot be made at the expense of others. I say to President Putin, I agree, but it is Russia's actions which threaten the international order on which we all depend.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.